వక్రతుండ మహాకాయ సూర్యకోటి సమప్రభ నిర్విఘ్నం కురు మే దేవ సర్వకార్యషు సర్వదా శివశక్త్యాయుక్తో యది భవతి శక్తః ప్రభవితుం న చేదేవం దేవో న ఖలు కుశలః స్పందితుమపి అతస్త్వామారాధ్య హరిహర విరించాదిభిరపి ప్రణంతుం స్తోతుం వా కతమకృత పుణ్యః ప్రభవతి.
Shri Sai Ram. At the outset, my most loving and prayerful salutations at the divine lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listener, you are tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony on Asia Stream, bringing you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the love and the message of Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba. Good morning. Greetings and loving Sai Ram on this Thursday morning on the 27th of February 2020, and you with me Team Radio Sai Sunil welcoming you to this morning's segment Divine Glory on Thursday Live from Prashantinilayam. Let me first read out to you today's Sai Inspires message. What should we do to refine our prayer and spiritual practices? Bhagwan lovingly reminds us today, and I quote, "Some meditate but get easily distracted by the smell from the kitchen. How can this be termed as a prayer to the Lord? All your spiritual practices are done with a wavering mind. Pray sincerely with a steady mind. You are bound to reap the fruits. Undertake any type of spiritual pursuit, but love wholeheartedly. Love eradicates all types of diseases and acts as a panacea for all afflictions. Hence, first cultivate love. This is possible only if you believe that God is the embodiment of love. Love is the best medicine. If you were to put a plant in a tin pot and water it, the plant will die in due course of time. But if you were to plant the same plant in the soil and water it, the plant would grow into a fine tree. To yield good fruits, God's name and form should be implanted in the soil of your heart and nurtured with water of love." Unquote. This was taken from a divine discourse delivered by Bhagwan on November 24th, 1998. Dear listener, the time right now is 51 minutes past 9 a.m. That is Indian Standard Time. And today in Divine Glory, I have lined up for you readings from the English version of the holy book, Sri Sai Satcharitra, written by Sri Hema Tanth, followed by the first part of a conversation with Dr. Alan Levy, a practicing psychoanalyst from the United States of America. First, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitra is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hemad Pant. We are thankful to Vasanthi Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book and to Veeramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing you all a holy and blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead. Here it is for your listening pleasure.
Immaculate Conception of Sai Baba and His First Advent in Shirdi. Nobody knew the parents, birth or birthplace of Sai Baba. Many inquiries were made, many questions were put to Baba and the others, but no satisfactory answer or information has yet been obtained. Practically, we know nothing about these matters. Namdev and Kabir were not born like ordinary mortals. They were found as infants in Mother of Pearls. Namdev was found on the bank Bhimrathi River by Gunai and Kabir on the bank Bhagirathi River by Tanmal. Similar was the case with Sai Baba. He first manifested himself as a young lad of 16 years under a neem tree in Shirdi for the sake of Bhaktas. Even then, he seemed to be full with the knowledge of Brahma. He had no desire for worldly objects, even in dreams. He kicked out Maya, and Mukti was serving at his feet. One old woman of Shirdi, the mother of Nana Chopdar, described him thus: "This young lad, fair, smart, and very handsome, was first seen under the neem tree seated in an asan. The people of the village were wonderstruck to see such a young lad practicing heart penance, not minding heat or cold. By day he associated with none, by night he was afraid of nobody. People were wondering and asking where this chap had turned up from. His form and features were so beautiful that a mere look endeared him to all. He went to nobody's door, always sat near the neem tree. Outwardly he looked very young, but by his action he was really a great soul. He was the embodiment of dispassion. He was an enigma to all. One day, it so happened that God Khandoba possessed the body of some devotee, and people began to ask him, 'Deva, you please inquire, what blessed father's son is this lad, and where has he come from?' God Khandoba asked them to bring a pickaxe and dig in a particular place. When it was dug, bricks were found underneath a flat stone. When the stone was removed, a corridor was seen, in which four lights were burning. The corridor led to a cellar, where cow mouth shaped structures, wooden boards, rosaries were seen. Khandoba said, 'This lad practiced penance here for 12 years. Then the people began to question the lad about this. He put them off the scene by telling them that was his guru's place, his holy vatan, and he requested them to guard it well. The people then closed the corridor as before. As Ashwatha and Audumba trees are held sacred, Baba regarded the neem tree equally sacred and loved it very much. Mahalsapati and other Shirdi devotees regard this site as a resting place, Samadhi Sthan of Baba's guru, and prostrate before it. Three Vadas. The site with the neem tree and the surrounding space was brought by Mr. Hari Vinayak Sate, and on this site a big building styled Sate's Vada was erected. This Vada was the sole resting place for pilgrims who flocked there. A par, or a platform, was built around the neem tree and locks with steps were constructed. Under the steps, there is a niche facing south and devotees sit on the par facing north. It's believed that he who burns incense there on Thursday and Friday evenings will, by God's grace, be happy. This Vada was old and dilapidated and needed repairs. The necessary repairs, additions and alterations have been made now by the Sansthan. Then after some years, another Vada, Dikshit's Vada, was constructed. Kaka Sahib Dikshit, solicitor of Mumbai, had gone to England. He had injured his leg in an accident there. The injury could not be got rid of by any means. Nana Sahib Chandorkar advised him to see Sai Baba. So, he went to Sai Baba in 1909 and requested him to cure the lameness of his mind rather than that of his leg. He was so much pleased with the darshan of Sai Baba that he decided to reside in Shirdi. So he built a Vada for himself and other devotees. The foundation of this building was laid on 10th December 1910. On this day, two other important events took place. Mr. Dada Saheb Kharpade was given permission to return home, and the night aarti at the Chavdi was started. The Vada was completed and inhabited on the Rav Navami day in 1911 with due rites and formalities. Another Vada was put up by the famous millionaire Mr. Bhuti of Nagpur. Lots of money was spent on this building, but all the amount was well utilized as Sai Baba's body is resting in this Vada, which is now called the Samadhi Mandir. The site of this Mandir formerly had a garden which was watered and looked after by Baba. Three Vadas thus came up where there was none before. Of these, Sathe's Vada was most useful to all in the early days. The story of the garden, which was attended by Sai Baba with the help of Vaman Tathya, the temporary absence of Sai Baba from Shirdi, his returning to Shirdi with the marriage party of Chand Patil, the company of Devi Das, Janki Das and Gangagir, Baba's wrestling match with Mohideen Tamboli residing in Masjid, love of Mr. Dengle and other devotees, and other incidents will be described in the next chapter. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 5. Baba's return with Chand Patil's marriage party, welcomed and addressed as Sai, contact with other saints, his attire and daily routine, the story of the Padukas, wrestling bout with Mohideen and change in life, turning water into oil, the pseudo-guru Jawahar Ali. Return with Chand Patil's marriage party. As hinted in the last chapter, I shall now describe first how Sai Baba returned to Shirdi after his disappearance. They lived in the Aurangabad district in a village called Dhoop, a well-to-do Mohammedan gentleman by name Chand Patil. While he was making a trip to Aurangabad, he lost his mare. For 2 long months, he made a diligent search, but could get no trace of the lost mare. After being disappointed, he returned from Aurangabad with a saddle on his back. After travelling 4.5 crores, he came on the way to a mango tree under the foot of which sat a fakir. He had a cap on his head, wore kafni, and had a satka under his arm, and he was preparing to smoke a chilim. On seeing Chand Patil pass by the way, he called out to him and asked him to have a smoke and to rest a little. The queer fellow or fakir asked him about the saddle. Chand Patil replied, it was of his mare which was lost some time back. The fakir asked him to search in the nala close by. He went, and wonder of wonders, Chand Patil found the mare there. He thought this fakir was not an ordinary man, but an avaliya, a great saint. He returned to the fakir with the mare. The chilim was ready for being smoked, but 2 things were wanting. Fire to light the pipe and water to wet the chapi, or the piece of cloth through which smoke is drawn up. The fakir took his prong and thrust it forcibly into the ground, and out came a live ember which he put on the pipe. Then he dashed the satka on the ground from where water began to ooze. The chapi was wetted with that water, wrung out and wrapped around the pipe. Thus everything being complete, the fakir smoked the chilim and then gave it also to Chand Patil. On seeing all of this, Chand Patil was wonderstruck. He requested the fakir to come to his home and accept his hospitality. Next day, he went to Patil's house and stayed there for some time. Patil was a village officer of Dhoop. His wife's brother's son was to be married and the bride was from Shirdi. So Patil made preparations to start for Shirdi for the marriage. The fakir also accompanied the marriage party. The marriage went off without any hitch. The party returned to Dhoop, except the fakir, who stayed back in Shirdi and remained there forever. How the fakir got his name Sai. When the marriage party came to Shirdi, it alighted at the foot of a banyan tree in Bhagat Mahalspati's field near Khandoba's temple. The carts were loosened in the open courtyard of Khandoba's temple, and the members of the party descended one by one, and the fakir also got down. Bhagat Mahalspati saw the young fakir getting down and accosted him, Ya Sai, which means welcome Sai. Others also addressed him as Sai, and from then he became Sai Baba. Contact with other saints. Sai Baba began to stay in a deserted masjid. One saint named Devi Das was living in Shirdi for many years before Baba came there. Baba liked his company and stayed with him in the Maruti temple in the Chavdi, and sometimes he lived alone. Then another saint by the name Janki Das also came there. Baba spent most of his time in talking with him, or Janki Das went to Baba's residence. So also in Vaishya household, a saint from Puntambe by name Gangagir always frequented Shirdi. When he first saw Sai Baba carrying pitchers of water in both hands for watering the garden, he was amazed and said openly, "Blessed is Shirdi that it got this precious jewel. This man is carrying water today, but he is not an ordinary fellow. As this land was fortunate and meritorious, it secured this jewel." Another famous saint by name Anandnath of Yawala Math, a disciple of Akalkot Maharaj, came to Shirdi with some people. And when he saw Sai Baba, he said openly, "This is a precious diamond in reality. Though he looks like an ordinary man, he is not an ordinary stone. He is a diamond. You will realize this in the near future." Saying this, he returned to Yawala. This was said while Sai Baba was still a youngster. Baba's dress and daily routine. In his young days, Sai Baba grew hair on his head, never had his head shaved. He dressed like an athlete. When he went to Rahata, which is about 3 miles from Shirdi, he brought with him small plants of marigold, jai and jui, and after cleaning, he planted and watered them. A devotee by name Vaman Tathya supplied him daily with 2 unbaked earthen pitchers. With these, Baba himself used to water the plants. He drew water from the well and carried the pitchers on his shoulder. In the evening, the pitchers were kept at the foot of the neem tree. As soon as they were placed there, they would break, as they were made of raw earth and not baked. Next day, Tathya would supply him with 2 fresh pitchers. This course went on for 3 years, and with Sai Baba's toil and effort, there grew a garden. On this site at present stands the big mansion Samadhi Mandir of Baba, which is now frequented and used by so many devotees. The story of Padukas under the neem tree. A devotee of Akalkot Maharaj by name Bhai Krishnaji Ali Bakkar worshipped the photo of Akalkot Maharaj. He once thought of going to Akalkot, which is in Solapur district, take the darshan of the Padukas of the Maharaj and offer his sincere prayer there. But before he could go there, he got a vision in his dream. Akalkot Maharaj appeared in the vision and said to him, "Now Shirdi is my resting place. Go there and offer your worship." So Bhai changed his plan and came to Shirdi, worshipped Baba, stayed there for 6 months and was very happy. As a reminiscence of this vision, he prepared the Padukas and installed them on an auspicious day of Shravan in 1912 AD under the neem tree with due ceremonies and formalities, which was conducted by Dada Kelkar and Upasani. One Dikshit Brahmin was appointed for worship and the management was entrusted to devotee Sagun. Complete version of the same story. Mr. B.V. Dev, retired Mamlatdar of Thana and a great devotee of Sai Baba, made inquiries about this matter with Sagun Meru Nayak and Govind Kamlakar Dikshit, and he has published a full version of the Padukas in Sai Leela. It runs as follows. In 1834 Shaka, which is 1912 AD, one Dr. Ram Rao Kothari of Mumbai came to Shirdi for Baba's darshan. His compounder and his friend Bhai Krishnaji Ali Bagkar accompanied him. The compounder and Bhai became intimate with Sagun Meru Nayak and G.K. Dikshit. While discussing these persons thought there must be some memorial of Sai Baba's first advent at Shirdi and sitting under the holy neem tree. They thought of installing Baba's Padukas there and were going to make them of some rough stone. Then Bhai's friend, the compounder, suggested if this matter was made known to the master, Dr. Ram Rao Kothari, he would prepare nice Padukas for this purpose. All liked the proposal and Dr. Kothari was informed of it. He came to Shirdi, drew a plan of the Padukas. He went to Upasani Maharaj in Kandhubha's temple and showed him the plan. The latter made many improvements, drew lotus, flowers, conch, disc, maize, etc. and suggested the following shloka regarding neem tree's greatness and Baba's yogic powers be inscribed. The verse was as follow. Sadhanimba vikshasya mooladhivasat sudhastravinam tiktam piyapriyatam tarum kalpa vrikshadhikam sadayantam namamishwaram sadguru sayinatam. Meaning, I bow to the Lord Sainath, who by his constant stay at the foot of the neem tree made the bitter and unpleasant taste of the neem leaves as sweet as oozing nectar, better than the kalpavriksh, a wish-fulfilling tree. Upasani's suggestions were accepted and carried out. The padukas were made in Mumbai and sent to Shirdi with a compounder. Baba said they should be installed on the Purnima day of Shravan. On that day, at 11 a.m., G.K. Dixit brought them on his head from the Khandoba's temple to the Dwaraka Mai in a procession. Baba touched the padukas, saying, "These are the feet of the Lord." He asked the people to install them under the foot of the neem tree. A day before, one Parsi devotee of Mumbai named Pastha Seth sent 25 rupees by money order. Baba gave the sum for the installation of the padukas. The total expense of installation came up to 100 rupees, of which 75 were collected by subscription. For the first 5 years, G.K. Dixit worshipped the padukas daily, and then this was done by Lakshman Kacheshwar Jakhadi. In the first 5 years, Dr. Kothare sent rupees 2 per month for lighting the lamps, and he also sent the railing around the padukas. The expense of bringing the railing from the station to Shirdi equaled 7 rupees 50 paise. The roofing was paid by Sagun Meru Nayak. Now, Jhakadi or Nana Pujari does the worship and Sagun Meru Nayak offers the Naivedya and lights the evening lamps. Bhai Krishnaji was originally a devotee of Akhalkot Maharaj. He had come to Shirdi at the installation of the padukas in Shaka 1834 on his way to Akhalkot. He wanted to go to Akhalkot after taking the darshan of Baba. He asked Baba's permission for this. Baba said, "Oh, what is there in Akhalkot? Why do you want to go there? The Maharaj of that place is here, which is myself." Hearing this, Bhai did not go to Akhalkot. He came to Shirdi off and on after the installation of the padukas. Mr. B.B. Dev concluded, "Hemat Pant did not know these details. Had he known them, he would have not failed to depict them in his Sai Satcharitra." Wrestling bout with Mohideen Tamboli and change in lifestyle. To return to other stories of Baba, there was a wrestler in Shirdi by name Mohideen Tamboli. Baba and he did not agree on some points and both had a fight. In this, Baba was defeated. Thenceforth, Baba changed his dress and his mode of living. He donned kafni, wore a langot and covered his head with a piece of cloth. He took a piece of sackcloth for his bed and was content with wearing torn and worn out rags. He always said that poverty is better than kingship, far better than lordship. The Lord is always brother of the poor. Gangagir was also very fond of wrestling. While he was once wrestling, a similar feeling of dispassion descended over him. And at the proper time, he heard the voice of an adept saying that he should wear out his body, playing with God. So he too gave up samsara and turned towards God realization. He established a mutt on the banks of the river near Puntambe and lived there with his disciples. Sai Baba did not mix and speak with the people. He only gave answers when he was questioned. By day, he always sat under the neem tree, sometimes under the shade of a babul tree, near the stream, at the outskirts of the village. In the afternoon, he would walk at random and go at times to Nimgaon. There, he frequented the house of Balasaheb Dhengli. Baba loved Mr. Balasaheb. His younger brother named Nana Saheb had no son, though he married a second wife. Balasaheb sent Nana Saheb for taking darshan of Sai Baba, and after some time with his grace, Nana Saheb got a son. From that time onwards, people began to come in numbers to see Sai Baba, and his fame began to spread and reached Ahmednagar. Nana Saheb Chandorkar and Keshav Chidambar and many others began to come to Shirdi. Baba was surrounded by his devotees during day and slept at night in an old and dilapidated masjid. Baba's paraphernalia at this time consisted of a chilim, tobacco, a tumbrel, which is also a tin pot. He wore a long kafni, a piece of cloth around his head and carried a satka, a short stick, which he always kept with him. The piece of white cloth on the head was twisted like matted hair and flowed down from the left ear on the back. This was not washed for weeks. He wore no shoes, no sandals. A piece of sackcloth was his seat for most of the day. He wore a waistcloth band, and for warding off cold, he always sat in front of a dhuni, which was facing south, and with his left hand resting on the wooden railing. In that dhuni, he offered an oblation of egoism, desires, and always uttered, "Allah Malik." The masjid in which he sat was only of two-room dimensions, where all devotees came and saw him. After 1912, there was a change. The old masjid was repaired and a pavement was constructed. Before Baba came to live in this masjid, he lived for a long time in a place, Takia, where with ghungru tied on his ankles, Baba danced beautifully and sang with tender love. Turning water into oil. Sai Baba was very fond of lights. He used to borrow oil from shopkeepers and keep lamps burning the whole night in the masjid and temple. This went on for some time. The Baniyas, who supplied oil for free, once met together and decided not to give him oil. When, as usual, Baba went to ask for oil, they all gave him a distinct no. Unperturbed, Baba returned to the masjid and kept the dry wicks in the lamps. The Baniyas were watching him with curiosity. Baba took the tin pot, which contained very little drops of oil, put water in it and drank it, and then forced it to fall into the container. After consecrating the tin pot in this way, he again took the water from the tin pot and filled all the lamps with it and lighted them. To the surprise and dismay of the watching Baniyas, the lamps began to burn and kept burning the whole night. The Baniyas repented, apologized, and Baba forgave them and asked them to be more truthful in the future. The pseudo guru Jawahar Ali. 5 years after the wrestling bout of the above mentioned, one fakir from Ahmednagar by named Jawahar Ali came to Rahata with his disciples and stayed in the spacious rooms near Veerabhadra temple. The fakir was learned, could repeat the whole Quran, and had a sweet tongue. Many religious and devout people of the village came to him and began to respect him. With the help of the people, he started to build an Eidgah near the Veerabhadra temple. There was some quarrel about this affair, on account of which Jawahar Ali had to leave Rahata. Then he came to Shirdi and lived in the masjid with Baba. People were captured by his sweet talk and he began to call Baba his disciple. Baba did not object. He consented to be his chela. Then both guru and chela decided to return to Rahata and live there. The guru never knew his disciple's worth, but the disciple knew the shortcomings of the guru. Still, he never disrespected him, observing carefully his duties. He even served the master in various ways. They used to come to Shirdi off and on, but their mainstay was in Rahata. The loving devotees of Baba in Shirdi did not like that Baba should stay away from them in Rahata, so they went in a deputation to bring Baba back to Shirdi. When they met Baba near the Eidgah and told the purpose for which they had come, Baba said to them, the fakir was an angry, ill-tempered fellow. He would not leave him, and that they should better go back to Shirdi without him before the fakir returned. While they were thus talking, the fakir turned up. He was very angry with them for trying to take away his disciple. There was some hot discussion and altercation, and it was finally decided that both the guru and the chela should return to Shirdi. And so they returned and lived in Shirdi for a long time. But after a few days, the guru was tested by Devidas and he was found wanting. 12 years before Baba arrived in Shirdi with the marriage party, this Devidas was about 10 or 12 years then. He came to Shirdi and lived in the Maruti temple. Devidas had fine features and brilliant eyes, and he was dispassion incarnate and a dhyani. Many persons, namely Tatya Khote, Kashinath and others, regarded him as their guru. They brought Jawahar Ali in his presence, and in the discussion that followed, Jawahar was worsted and fled from Shirdi. He went and stayed in Bijapur and returned after many years to Shirdi and prostrated himself before Sai Baba. The delusion that he was guru and Sai Baba his chela was cleared away, and as he repented, Sai Baba treated him with respect. In this case, Sai Baba showed by his conduct how one could get rid of egoism and do the duties of a disciple to attain the highest end of self-realization. This story is told here according to the version by Mahal Sapathi. In the next chapter will be described Ram Navami festival, the masjid, its former condition and later improvement. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all.
Sai Guru Var ki Paramanand Sada
Tune in to Sight.
Spend the day with Sight.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Sai Ram, dear listeners. In our series of Conversations with Sai Devotees, today we have for you a special conversation with Dr. Ellen Levy from United States of America. Dr. Levy is a practicing modern psychoanalyst for 30 years. More importantly, he has been coming to Bhagwan Baba for an equal number of years and has been privileged to be guided by Bhagwan on his spiritual path, especially purifying his inner self through meditation. In conversation with Dr. Levy is Radio Sai's Mr. Bishu Prusti, a former student of Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning. This program was recorded in the studio of Radio Sai on April 30th, 2011.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, in the studios of Radio Sai today, our guest is Dr. Ellen Levy. Dr. Ellen is a practicing modern psychoanalyst from Westport, Connecticut, USA. Before moving to Connecticut in 2000, he was in private practice in Manhattan for 20 years. He is also a senior faculty member of the Center for Group Studies in Manhattan and past faculty member, Union Graduate School, Cincinnati, Ohio. He has been in this profession, serving people with mental and psychological ailments for over 3 decades. But his practice has a unique dimension to it, thanks to the personal guidance and direction given by Bhagwan. And what is it that is unique about his practice? And how has Swami guided him? And before all this, how did Swami actually draw him to his fold? We will try to unravel all this and probably more in today's conversation. So welcome Dr. Ellen Levy to the studios of Radio Sai.
Well, thank you very, very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's an honor, and I'm very grateful to you and Radio Sai for inviting me to share my life story with Swami.
Why don't you start by telling us a little bit more about yourself than what I mentioned, just so that people get a better idea of who Ellen Levy is as a person as well as a professional and also as a devotee.
Well, there's a lot there. My father was the president of Fulton Fish Market in Manhattan, and he had inherited the business from my grandfather, who had been the first person to bring scallops to America. And this was an honor in my mind, but it was a very violent family.
Mm-hmm.
And I came into it by choice, of course, because that's what we know. We choose our parents. But it was difficult.
But unconsciously.
Superconsciously in heaven. But, you know, it was a difficult family to grow up in.
Mm-hmm.
My mother loved me very much, but she could not offset the violence of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a brother who was wonderful, and a sister later in life, 7 years later, and she was wonderful. When I awakened suddenly from a materiality of life, because I was just very concrete and very sensually oriented, very materially oriented, a bit intelligent, so I did well in school, but that was to my deficit. It was not good for me because it just made my belief in materiality and my belief in the material world stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So I was about 17, and suddenly something occurred inside of me that was an awakening spiritually. And I became aware of not only the inner mental processes, but beyond the inner mental processes, I felt there was something much deeper, an ocean current that was sweeping me into a mystical world that I did not know of or had no familiarity with, was never introduced to before.
So did this happen all of a sudden, or was it a slow process?
No, it happened suddenly because I was a skier. I was brought up as a snow skier. So me and my friends from high school in our senior year had gone on a ski trip. And in that time, over a weekend, I didn't sleep more than a couple of hours every night because it was just fun being with friends. Mm. We were living cleanly, but we skied all day and then talked all night and then a couple of hours of sleep. And after 3 days of this, suddenly my mind shattered. And it was like I was living a dream. And I had no awareness of why. And I didn't understand what was really happening. And since I had grown up in a troubled situation, my subconscious mind began to empty itself spontaneously into the normal waking state. And it was very confusing for me and very scary. And at the same time, I felt this deep underlying current of love. But I was not familiar with it. So in that state, I became a little bit depressed, confused, and my whole world shattered around me.
At that point, you were actually confused. You really didn't know what was happening to you, but there was something deep happening.
Correct. That's right. That lasted about 3 months, 4 months, and then it started calming down. And when it calmed down, I realized that God really did somehow exist. But I had no relationship with God.
Before that, you didn't have any faith in God?
No, because I had grown up in a situation, especially in Hebrew school, that was very ritualized, concrete as well, and still violent. The teachers did not like the students did not like each other. It was the opposite of what Swami has created in Prashanti Nilayam as a university and a college for the students, and the opposite of what education and human values is all about. So basically, I didn't believe in God all that time. I didn't think God existed.
Even though you were in a Hebrew school.
Correct. But I learned the Hebrew language, I learned the rituals, I learned the ceremonies, I got bar mitzvahed. It was a nice experience that way, but it didn't relate to God at all for me. So this suddenly that I knew God existed was a bit scary. Because knowing God existed meant that I somehow was responsible for what I did prior to that awakening. And that was scary because I was not a nice person. I was very selfish. I didn't care about others and what happened to others at all. I was just interested in one person, me. And I realized in that awakening God existed. Now I had to answer for my own actions. And I was responsible for them. I realized that. So it was scary. Because what did I know about God? I thought God was like we were taught in Hebrew school. God will punish you if you do the wrong thing. And I feared God then.
So you didn't have a training in the Hebrew school to relate to God as someone who's loving?
Not at all. No. As a matter of fact, just the opposite. That, you know, God led the Israelis out of Egypt, the Jewish people as slaves, and he was going to punish those that had treated them badly, but he would also punish the Jewish people if they acted badly as well. And I was in that mindset, Jewish, and I had acted badly. So I feared, oh my God, this is going to be terrible. God exists. So then what I did was I went to college, just before college, when this was going through my mind, I dulled my mind. I dulled my awareness deliberately. I dulled everything I knew, everything that had opened up. I did some drugs and acted badly and tried to forget about what had happened.
Trying to suppress this new feeling.
Correct. And I went to college, and in college, in the first year, I was doing really well. I got straight A's. I had a good social life, but that was really not good in the eyes of the Lord, actually. But for me, it was good. And I had a lot of friends, huge crowd of friends, and I was on the soccer team for varsity or JV soccer, actually. And so life was good. Then one of my friends said, you know, these people are coming to the school to teach meditation, and I'm going to go learn. Do you want to come learn? And I went, what do you have to do to learn meditation? And my friend said, well, you got to give up drugs for 2 weeks. I said, I'm really enjoying this. I'm getting straight A's. I have friends. I'm on the soccer team. I don't need anything more than that. I'm happy. And he said to me, well, it's really good. Meditation is very good for you. And I said, okay, look, if that's true, in 6 months, come back to me. If you're still doing the meditation, you think it's good, come back to me, tell me, and then I will do meditation also. I'll give up the drugs. I'll do what you want, which you suggest. And he said, okay, and we made that agreement. And then some of my other friends also were doing it, so they all said the same thing to me. Yeah, we'll do it, and then we'll come back to you. So I like that. And then in about 6 months, they did come back to me. Mm-hmm. And they said, this is really wonderful, a couple of them. And they were on the soccer team, too, so I believed them. Mm. So they were my buddies. And I said, okay, I promised I'd do this. I would give up drugs and learn to meditate. So I learned from the Transcendental Meditation people how to meditate. They were coming to school and they taught. And I called my brother up, who was in high school, and said, Lou, I'm going to learn to meditate this weekend. Why don't you come up, stay in my room in college? He was in high school, and learn too. So he did. For the first time I learned meditation, I sat down, I closed my eyes, I started the meditation like they taught, and fireworks went off inside me. It was an amazingly deep experience that was totally different than anything I had ever had as an experience before. And I thought, what is this? And from that moment on, I meditated every day for at least 20 minutes, sometimes a little longer, and twice a day, mostly. And at the same time, I thought, well, but I can keep my social life, I can keep my drugs occasionally, and, you know, it was just marijuana. But it was still, as Swami later said to me and others, false grapes and not helpful. But I didn't drink, so I just continued life in college and meditated. I believe maybe God existed, but maybe he didn't. That's my rationalization of my socializing life, my social life. You know, it was the way the mind rationalized things so we can do bad things, basically. Mm. Even though we know it's bad. So, for some time I just meditated and had a good life, about a year and a half. And then I realized, I'm not getting anywhere here. I had started studying Swami's teachings. I had heard about Swami through a woman named Hilda Charlton. Mm-hmm. And my brother had took me to a class of meditation with her that happened in Manhattan. And I met her, and she had been with Swami for a whole year. She was the first Westerner ever to come to Swami in 1964-65. And after that year with Swami, Swami said to her, no more lives, Hilda, no more births. Mm-hmm. And she said, Swami, I want to help. Can't I have one more life with you? This is what she shared with me later. And Swami looked into the air, thought a minute. I guess he was arranging the universe for her, and then looked at her and said, okay, Hilda, one more. So she came back to America after that experience, enlightened. Swami said, Hilda has no mind. A diamond is a very precious stone, but a diamond is the greatest treasure in the universe. And so without a mind, a person is totally realized. They are one with God. And she had come back to America and helped people like me who were doing bad things as hippies and other types of people, you know, and taught us how to love God, how to serve God and everyone, and the path that Swami had taught. So I had met her. But I was in college, so I would go back to college, which was in Florida at this point, and she was in New York. And while in Florida, occasionally I would pray to Swami, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I was confused again, Do I take a spiritual path? Do I practice Swami's teachings? Or do I enjoy myself with this pleasure of the world thing that I was experiencing in college?
You started believing in Swami.
Oh, yes.
How did that happen? You just heard about Swami from Hilda and your faith in Swami.
Well, my brother met Hilda after meditating, and I was still in college. He came to the house one day while I was home on a weekend, and he said, I have met the Divine Mother, and I have met God. And I said, Lou, you've been meditating too much. You're crazy. And he looked at me like, I will show you. Here's their pictures. He showed me a picture of Hilda, the Divine Mother, as he called her. And then he showed me a picture of Swami, who looked like a rock star to me. And I thought, he looks like a rock star. He looks like Jimi Hendrix. I mean, who is this? And he's calling him God. My brother's really flipped out. He's crazy. And then he said, okay, you can say whatever you want. Think about this. And so we spent the weekend together with family and everything like that. Things passed as normal. And then that was in October. It was Rosh Hashanah. Then I came back in for Thanksgiving, which was November in America. And he said to me, my brother said, I have a book for you to read. And he gave me the book, Baba, by Arnold Schumann. Now, he also had invited me to his apartment to give me this book in New York City and to a class of Hilda's. So we were going to go to a class of meditation with Hilda. That's where I met Hilda for the first time. And before that, he took me to the apartment and he was playing bhajans in the apartment. But I didn't know it was bhajans. Mm-hmm. It was actually bhajans. There was a record that was made long ago of Swami. On one side of the record was Swami's revelation of himself and his mission that Sri Kasturi had translated for in English while Swami spoke in Telugu. And on the other side of the record were very popular bhajans of the time. So he was playing these bhajans.
Sung by Swami himself.
Sung by Swami himself. Mm-hmm. And he was playing these bhajans in the apartment in Manhattan, a little apartment on Eldridge Street. I would walk in, and I heard the bhajans, and suddenly I started dancing spontaneously. I was dancing in joy, like a Jewish person, twirling in circles and very happy. And I said to my brother, what's this? And he was laughing, watching me, because I looked like a nut. And I said, what's this? He said, that's Sai Baba singing bhajans. I said, this is really wonderful. This was so elevating to me to hear. I had never heard anything like it. So we went to a class with Hilda, and that's when I met Hilda, and she told me more about Sai Baba. So I was in college then. And after about a year of knowing this, I said to myself, I can't keep having a social life and ignoring Swami's teachings, you know, about smoking marijuana and having a party here and there, having a girlfriend here and there, all these things that Westerners do in college, and meditate. I have to pick one or the other. I have to choose the spiritual life and meditation, or just go back to the world and have a material life and enjoy. I need to make a choice. So I sat down, I meditated on that. The only thing I knew what to do. I said, Swami, please show me if you are real, if God is really real, personally in my life, then I will choose. But you need to show me. I will choose God, but you need to show me. And he did. He showed me in that night that I meditated for at least 2 hours. I had never meditated like that before. And I walked outside and everything was glowing with an energy of life that I had never seen before. All the plants, all the trees, the people, something had opened up in me by the grace of Swami that I had never experienced. And then I said, well, this is nature. This is. How do I know this is God? Everything's glowing, but it's glowing with the light of nature and energy and life. Where's God? So I just sat down and I thought the only way I could get any deeper is to Om, like Omkar. And so I Omed really intensely for a lot, more than 21 times. It must have been 100 times. I don't know. I sat and just owned. And all of a sudden in me was like an electricity that rose from the base of my spine and shot through my spine and burst into like a nuclear explosion in my head. And I said to myself, I don't know if I could take this. But at the same time, my consciousness expanded into this oneness of light that was the entirety of creation. The entirety of the universe was just oneness of light. And I was one with that. And I thought, well, I don't know that this is God, but if it's the closest I'll ever experience God this moment. And if it is something, it's the shadow of God. That's what I thought. It's the reflection of God. And God is real. That was my experience, that moment. My direct cognition of that through Swami's grace. It was totally Swami's blessing. I know he picked me out of the mud and said, okay, come on, come into something sublime, come into something spiritual, come into the spiritual life with me, and showed me that he was real. God is real. And I said, that's it. And from that moment on, I never smoked another cigarette. I never smoked or did any more drugs. I never drank another glass of alcohol, not even a glass of wine. I didn't go out with women. Nothing. That was it. That was finished. And I just sat and I said, Swami, I'm yours. You do what you want with me. That's it. Shortly thereafter, Swami came in a dream to me. And in this dream, he said, under a lily white arch, and he said, you are mine. And he gave me a ring in the dream, which in the earthly life he never did. And he took me and hugged me, and that was that. And when I first came to India in 78 and had an interview with Swami, I said, Swami, I had this dream. He said to me, do you want marriage? Physically, you know, in the interview. Do you want marriage? I said, no, Swami, no, I don't want marriage. Because by this time, I had been taking care of Hilda because I got close to her and I was her driver. I was, you know, like a confidant. I was a student. And she was telling me about Swami. But the only way I could come back to Swami was to take Hilda with me and 20 of her students. And we all arrived here in 78 together. And then Swami called us in for an interview. And it was nice. It was wonderful. And then Swami said to me, you know, you want marriage? And I said, no, Swami, I want only you. I don't want marriage. I just want you. He said, no, I'll give you a wife. Swami, no, no. I should not have said that to Swami, because you never say no to Swami. Swami is the will of God. Swami is God, and you do God's will, no matter what. That's surrender. That's real surrender. But that time I didn't have that awareness. So then I said, Swami, only you, please. Please, Brahmacharyas, please, Swami, please. He said, okay. And from then on, and then I asked him about the dream. I said, is it true? Is it true, Swami, I'm yours? Is it true that this dream happened and you put a ring on my finger? He said, yes. I said, that's all. That's all. I only want to know that. That's it. I'm yours. Whatever you say. Whatever you say.
So from then on, I guess you must have had more opportunities of interaction with Bhagwan.
Many. Many, especially.
Because it was in the 70s, right? 70s and 80s.
That was 78, and then I came as often as I could, two or three times a year sometimes. Swami would call me in occasionally, but there were long periods when I wouldn't have an interview or any discussion with Swami, even words, like 5 years, 7 years. Then all of a sudden he'd call me in and give me four interviews, or, you know, when he finally I did get married, you know. Hilda passed on, and I came directly here afterward and stayed here for 10 months. And in that 10 months, Swami was so wonderful, and he called me in four times, and he really did want me to get married. He asked me, on the first time he called me in, coming back, where is your wife? I said, Swami, in you, Swami. He goes, ah, like he's going to slap me on the cheek. Everything's in me. He looks at me like that. Everything's in me. With his face like 3 inches from my face. Like, listen. You know, this is your God. God talking to you. And he said that, I just was like, Swami, you're everything, whatever you say, Swami. And then he said, where is your wife? And I turned around. My wife was with me in the back, but we weren't married or anything like that. But we had thought about it a little. Mm. And so I said, my wife Roseanne's right here. He said, yes, and I will marry you.
Oh.
Who could want more than that? The Lord himself says, I will marry you. Here's your wife. I'll marry you.
I'll perform your marriage.
Right. Mm. He said that. So then he kept us here, my wife and I, for 10 months.
Mm.
Now, I was very confused about that because I was trained to be a sannyasi in the 15 years I was with Hilda. And, I was close to her like one would be close to Swami. If one's close to Swami, you don't think about marriage, you don't think about wife, you think about Swami, you think about God, you think about serving the Lord. If he says, bring the coffee or bring the tea, or you bring the tea, you bring the coffee. If he says, go and sit over there, you go and sit over there. You do complete surrender. So that was the way I was with Hilda, or at least tried to be. You know, I wasn't perfect by a long shot. Had a lot of faults. And still do. But I tried. And so now Swami was saying, get married. So I didn't understand how to do that. I didn't know how to make that transition. So in that 10 months, Swami would talk to me about it all the time and wait to see if I was less confused. And finally, he calls me in and says, how are you? And I go, Swami, you told me I should be married, but I've been sannyas for 15 years and I don't know how to. He says, don't worry, sannyas is inside, not outside.
Mm-hmm.
Sannyas is in the heart. It's not an outer thing. And so then Swami didn't marry us. He sent us out, gave us his blessings to be married. I said, Swami, marry us, please. I will bless, I will bless, I will bless. Swami, please, please marry him. I bless, I am there. I am with you. I'm blessed. Swami, please marry us. Please, Swami, you said you would marry us. Please, Swami, please marry us. Blessings. Then he sent us out, and I'm like, oh, nuts. I must have done something really wrong. Swami won't marry us. He said he was going to marry us. I must have been too confused for too long. Now I've really blown it, and now what? Swami is not happy with me. He sent us home, and I get home. And my parents say, thank God you're home. I said, why thank God I'm home? Well, you stayed there 10 months. We were worried. But I wanted to get married. Swami was going to marry us. No, they said. We prayed that he would send you home. We wanted you to get married here. I went, why did you do that? But then I understood. Mm. Parents first, and they're, when it comes to the body, the body belongs to parents. The parents are God. The parents deserve that respect. No matter what way they faulted, they deserve that respect. They had prayed to Swami, and Swami answered their prayers, sent me home, sent my wife Roseanne home. Our parents were like, well, we liked that you would be married here, but we were okay with if Swami married you. They weren't perfect about that either. So the parents, both sides, were sort of like desiring us to be home and married, and that's what Swami answered their prayer. And they were very grateful.
Mm. So. Wonderful. So now coming to your training in meditation. Yes. I understand that there were a lot of instances where Swami guided you personally about meditation, how it should be done. And it's not only the technique, but also the fineness and the bhava with which it should be done, right?
Yes. We were very fortunate. Both my wife and I, we were very fortunate that Swami had given us a lot of instruction directly on meditation. Mainly because she meditated, naturally. That was her inclination. But I had been a transcendental meditation teacher before. After college, I went off-campus study, and that was my off-campus study. But I left Mahesh Yogis because it was involved with money, and I felt it was wrong. When Swami called us in 78, the first thing he said, one of the first things he says to me is, meditation is free. Don't charge money for it. So I was very surprised. And I, of course, abided by that ever since. I had felt that was wrong to charge money for meditation, and it is, and Swami was confirming that. And then I said to Swami in subsequent days, Swami, because he talked to me a lot that year. He was just, you know, I was the infant on the spiritual path, and he was holding me and guiding me and taking care of me and rocking me and nurturing me, and he, every day almost, he would talk whenever I asked a question. So I said, Swami, people are coming to me to learn meditation. It's what I used to teach, but I only want to teach your meditations. May I have permission to do that? He said, in an interview subsequent to that, you cannot teach meditation. No one could teach meditation. You can share meditation, because meditation is a state of consciousness. You can share it. It's natural to you. But you cannot teach it. You can't charge money for it. It's natural, like the breath. So, like that. So then, people, I asked, because people were asking me to share meditation with them and teach them. So, Swami said, yes, you may share it. You may share it. So in my room, occasionally people would come, I'd share the meditation. But then many people would be coming, like 10, 15. I asked Swami, this was later in 88, Swami, many people are coming to the room. What shall we do? And so he looked at us, and nothing, didn't say a word. So we had the thought that maybe we could have a shed, and these people could all come together, and we could share meditation. And so Kasturi himself and Hislop, Dr. Hislop himself, asked Swami about this. They want to share meditation in the shed. Can they do that? And Swami said, yes. Have them do that and assign the shed, and have them do it after bhajans in the morning, and that will be fine. So for a whole 5 or 6 months when we were staying here for a year, people every morning would, from 10 to 11 a.m., come to the shed, and we would have 100, 200, 300 Westerners and some Indians all sitting in circles according to their translation, you know, leading meditations that Swami had shared with us. Soham meditation, Jyoti meditation, name and form meditation, self-inquiry meditation, Dharana meditations, all these different meditations.
Swami had directed you about all these kinds of meditations?
Yes. Some things he had spoken directly to us about, and some things when we would ask, he wouldn't say anything, and then we would find his article or speech in the Sanatana Sarathi about it, like Dharana. And so, like that. One thing Swami said is, meditation is a state of consciousness. You cannot meditate. But you can concentrate. Concentration is the first stage of the process of meditation. Then you can contemplate. From that, contemplation comes. And then the mind in contemplation is transcended. And there is a state of equanimity beyond mind. That is meditation. That is a state of consciousness beyond mind. And like that, Swami would say.
In fact, you mentioned three words, concentration, contemplation, and meditation. And I'm just reminded of one beautiful quote where Bhagavan very beautifully explains the difference between all the three. He says that there are three stages in the spiritual sadhana. And concentration entails fixing your gaze on one form. But contemplation occurs when you are able to perceive the form within you. Mm-hmm. You know, even in its absence. But meditation means when, as a result of this exercise, this form is permanently imprinted in your heart. That's how Swami distinguished between concentration, contemplation, and meditation. And then he continued to say that if one continue to meditate in this manner, then the form will get constantly fixed in that person's heart, and one should not really confine oneself to concentration or contemplation. One should go beyond to meditation, and when one carries this out, then he or she will visualize the form of God at all times. And then Swami says that is how the ancient rishis were able to see God. You know, when they used to think about God, they used to see the manifestation of God. It was because God was so permanently, constantly, so solidly imprinted in their hearts. And when I reflect on this, in the changed circumstances now, it's so important now for us to just keep Swami permanently, constantly in our hearts, because darshan is always there. Darshan was probably was much easier before, but even now it is there, but you have to work for it.
Yes.
If you really meditate on Him so much, if you have Him within you so strongly that you feel Him, then probably you can even now have His darshan.
Absolutely true. That is so true. And Swami is, and always has been, universal and everywhere, and in everyone. This is where we need to be, and not that I'm there, but I am, like everybody else, walking toward that goal of seeing Him, the essence of reality, the form and the formless, in everyone and in everything. But first, it has to come from within. It has to be seen in our heart, this form. And then the form, Swami has said, when you see the form and you are merged in the form, don't hang on just to the form, even in your own heart. Go beyond name, go beyond form. He showed this to many devotees in the past. One of them was Hilda. She had a vision when, at the end of her stay, towards the end of her stay of a year with Swami, in 64-65, that Swami's picture shattered into a billion pieces and became the universe. And beyond that. And she didn't understand what this meant. So she asked Swami directly, Swami, she had the opportunity. What? She told the experience and then said, what does this mean, Swami? And Swami said, go beyond name, go beyond form, to her. And subsequently, she was fully enlightened and fully liberated as a result of Swami's teachings and doing that, just that.
That is the principle of unity, the ekatma bhava that Swami all the time has been stressing. You know, when Swami says that, I know I am God, but you too are God.
Yes.
It's just that you do not know. The underlying ultimate truth behind all these statements is this principle of unity. That's how He wants all of us to cultivate.
Yes, absolutely true. See, we see Swami in our heart, and we think, oh, I am one with Swami in my heart. I am one with Swami in my heart. That is only a stage. What is most important is seeing God in everyone, loving God in everyone, serving God in everyone, because it's our own self. That is God. So the pain of another is our pain.
Yes.
The suffering of another is our suffering. And we want to alleviate that. We want to relieve that. Just as Swami saved us and relieved us from the suffering and pain of our lives and brought us from delusion and illusion to some higher state of conscious awareness of reality. And certainly, ultimately, He will bring us to the conscious awareness of the supreme reality of our oneness, our unity in Him, in God. This is where we all arrive as sadhakas, as devotees.
I was just reading one article that you had written quite some time ago, and which was published in the book Transformation of the Heart. And towards the end of that article, you say, I quote, my life has turned from concerns of self into a sharing of the burdens of life that others seem to bear. The real value of this life I call mine has become the intense desire to respond to the cry of pain from another, who are my own self in disguise. By the grace of God, I love, and in that loving, I give. And I pray that the giving be so constant, so deep, that one day realization of the oneness of giver and the receiver, the true nature of being, be eternal in this consciousness.
Yes.
What I want to ask you is, you are by profession a psychoanalyst. Yes. And of course, given all this training and spiritual instruction and spiritual enlightenment that Swami has graced you with, it would have definitely affected your practice as a psychoanalyst. All this consciously or unconsciously must have seeped into your practice.
Yes, it has.
Yeah. I would like to know how you have been able to do this and what impact it has had in your profession of trying to alleviate the pain, mental and psychological pain of the people who come to you?
So, I think that people are in anguish mentally and emotionally because they have lost an awareness of their own center, of their own self, even in a rudimentary awareness of self. They're just lost in the sufferings of their mind. So, to come out of those sufferings, we must understand the nature of the mind. The awareness of desires and attachments and delusions and illusions and the imaginations that we have inside and the reactions and the reflections and the resounds of karmas from the past and all these things mixed together with the seeds of the past known as vasanas, we must understand that that is all contained within the mind, both conscious, preconscious, and subconscious. But there is the buddhi, which is the higher mind or superconscious mind, that is overshadowed by the repression of pain and suffering, and even some pleasurable experiences are in the repressed mind known as the subconscious. But the enlightened person does not have a mind. The subconscious mind has dissolved. The superconscious mind, or the buddhi, in the truly enlightened person who has one with God, is also dissolved. They are just the awareness of reality, Satchitananda. So I had the experience to be with Hilda, and I would ask her constantly, what is this about? You don't think with the mind. She said, no, I think intuitively. It comes to me impulsively what to do. But it's a sublime impulse. It's an intuitional impulse. So I could explore with her, what does that mean? So Swami had, you know, given me the pain and suffering and delusion as a student, the depths of suffering, and then brought me to Hilda to understand the realities of the sublime spiritual life in one.
But how did this help you as a psychoanalyst?
So I would bring this to practice. I would bring this into my practice with my patients. So what they would tell me is all their pain and suffering, just like we would share with Swami in an interview perhaps sometimes. And I would sit and listen. But Swami said to me specifically in one interview, we asked, friends and I, who are psychologists, asked, Swami, how do you practice psychotherapy? And we thought he was going to give a long discourse. He said, simply, see me in everyone. Just like that. Such a simple answer. So deep. See me in everyone. See the light of truth that is in everyone. Maintain that visualization. Focus on that. Let all else dissolve. Then another occasion, I asked Swami, is everything really your will? When bad things happen, like Nazi Germany, where half my family was killed in Europe, is that your will? He didn't elaborate very much. He said, everything is my will. He didn't even say, well, that's ego, some things happen out of negativity. Everything is my will. It was hard to understand. When negative things happen, is that Swami's will? In the tamasic and rajasic sense of it, yes. It happens through rajasic and tamasic activities that people are engaged in ego. The will of God flows through that tamasic and rajasic quality and comes out colored. Negative things happen. That is God's will. So why? There's a balance and a perception of reality is far beyond us. The purpose of life is so far beyond us. And so I said to Swami, Nazi Germany, come on. You don't understand. There are no victims. That's what Swami said directly.
Hmm.
What a profound thing. Only God understands the realities beyond us.
We never know the larger picture.
Never. Only God. And Swami would often say to me, because I would think I know something. He'd say, I know you don't. Let your ego go. You know, surrender. That was what he was saying. I know. Often he would say, I know. So, what happened? The fact is, everything is the will of God. Then I asked him, Swami, what about anger? On another occasion, is that the will of God? He said, just bubbles. So, he was saying to me and to others, there were many in the room at the time, that the things we go through emotionally, mentally, the agitations of the mind, are just bubbles. Let them go. They're illusions. Focus on the truth. And this is what I would do with the patients that I was with. They would say what they said, and then I say, who are you? Who are you? They'd say, oh, I'm a woman, I'm a man, I'm a wife, I'm a husband, I'm a shopkeeper, I'm a teacher, I'm a professor, I'm a student. I say, well, that's what the body is, but who is it that is in the body? They would say, oh, my mind's in the body. And then I'd say, well, but you could watch the mind. You can be aware of your mind from a distance, like a witness. So who is watching the mind when it goes through all this? Who is it that is watching the mind? They would say, oh, I don't know, I don't know. I say, watch the mind and find out who you are, because that is who you are, the witness of the mind. You are alive. You are being. You are experiencing the mind in its delusion and its pain and suffering, but you are not. You are not that. That is how, over time, my practice evolved with my patients. And occasionally...
It's so much... Actually, psychoanalysis actually is so much spiritual. I don't know when this discipline was founded, whether it had so much of spiritual underpinnings, but... When you have the spiritual aspect, this whole profession gets such a beautiful and complete dimension.
It gets illuminated. See, Freud himself, at the end of his life, regretted that he didn't understand more deeply the mind than the subconscious mind provided. Swami said this in a lecture. He wanted to study the psychic mind.
Freud.
Freud said this. Swami revealed this in a lecture, in a speech once. I was very surprised. I was sitting there, and Swami suddenly comes out with this. It was very illuminating to me. And Swami was basically saying Freud himself regretted that he didn't become more spiritual, that he wasn't aware of the spiritual dimension of the mind. He regretted it. Swami was like saying that. Now, people would dispute that and debate that, but Swami being all-knowing, Swami knew. As he said to me once, I know. Not more than once. So, basically, if we bring the reality of who we are to the awareness of therapy, to the patient, the person we're working with, then they have the opportunity to have an appropriate perspective on their mind. And they can begin to release, like Swami helped us release, the pain and suffering of our past. And it works. So some people would want medication. And they'd say, but I want a pill. I want to take my pill and get relieved. I said, you know what? That's temporary relief. It's not going to do anything. And ultimately, you're going to have to face yourself. You have to face your fire. You have to walk through the fire of your mind and be willing to face the fears that you have. I'll help you. Because Swami showed us the way. So I would help them with meditation, because meditation provided them with a detached perspective where they were beyond the mind for even a second or two, and they could begin to release this. And many of my patients ended up meditating. My dissertation for PhD was on the psychoanalytic study of meditating patients versus non-meditating patients. And meditating patients did better in the psychoanalytic process because they had that perspective that was a bit more detached and witness. They were the witness of their mind's activities. It worked. So, yes, modern psychoanalysis especially is more illumined by the processes of Swami's teachings and the perspectives of meditation when used together.
That's wonderful. It's great to know how Swami is using you as an instrument to help so many people who are traumatic mentally, psychologically, and all the training that Swami gave you for so many years is finding its fulfillment. I know life must be now a wonderful experience for you, given all that Swami has given you, and the very fact that you're able to help so many people not only become mentally and psychologically better, but also start thinking about themselves as a spiritual being is so wonderful.
It's Swami. Always, it is only Swami doing this. This is not anything of personal. It's, I pray all the time, Swami, you do this. I am not the doer. You are the doer. You are the process of doing. You are everything, the goal and the beginning, the end, and the process between. You are the person sitting before me. You are me. You do this. So that, when awareness of that, whatever happens, that's what happens. I'm not attached to the result. That's Swami's result. It has nothing to do with me. But reality is, it is Swami who brought me out of the mud, a derelict, deluded, in illusion, picked me up, held me in his arms, carried me, helped me to walk, helped me to stand, living his teachings. Every day I pray I live his teachings more fully and more deeply, so that humanity, whoever is before me, can be helped to live the life that Swami wants us all to live. Ultimately, you know, Swami is not in the body any longer. He'll be again pretty soon as Prema Sai Baba. But really our purpose of living this moment is to see Swami in everyone and to love him in everyone and to serve him in everyone. And if we can do that, just think about this. Maybe there are 10 million devotees throughout the world of Sai Babas. Maybe there are 50 million. Who knows? Only Swami knows. But if each of us were to live these teachings of Swami, these teachings fully, more fully and completely, and love all and serve all, then be unified in the oneness of Swami and be who we are, God in human form, just as Swami is God in human form and we are one, then what happens? There are 10 million avatars in this world.
That is golden age.
Then it will simply happen in a blink of an eye. The earth will be transformed. The people of the humanity will be transformed. All beings will be transformed. We will be a beacon to the universe of creation. All beings in creation will say, they have lived the Lord's teachings. They are one with God. They are God. This transformation has occurred. The entire universe will be transformed. Nothing will ever be the same. We are the devotees of the Lord. We, if we live his teachings, honor his life as he lived it here. And he has said, beginning he said, my life is my message. Then he said, your life is my message. This is our mission. This is our goal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think every devotee is now geared up to be his messenger, to be one who carries his love in his heart and shares his love. And we see that now happening everywhere. And I think that is the dawn of the golden age. Thank you very much for sparing your time.
Jai Sai Ram. Thank you too.
You just heard a special conversation with Dr. Aaron Levy, a practicing modern psychoanalyst from United States of America. In conversation with him was Mr. Bishu Prusti of Radio Sai. This was recorded in the studio of Radio Sai on April 30th, 2011. If you have any comments or feedback on this program, please feel free to write to us at listener@radiosai.org. Thank you. Sai Ram from Prashanti Nilayam.